I was actually thrilled because we made I'm Too Sexy. We had a plug-in company called Station to Station, and we got that in the charts to number two, and stayed at number two for many, many weeks. So we made a shilling. So
I understand as
absolutely classic.
Well, I understand as well. It's the first UK song to go number one in the US.
That's right. As well, absolutely right. Yeah, and they'd be huge, and they are still huge. I mean, they're the Deeply Dippy. I think went to number one as well. But incredible musicians. Just for some reason, it was Novelty Records. But I'm Too Sexy brings them in a couple of million a year. Which is absolutely. And we then launched Alvin Stardust Info from my mum's house in Northfield, in Lower Beaches Road, and we did that for a few years. And I did PR for Alvin. Begged him to let me do roadie, and he said, no, you're too good for roadie. And I did roadie for a week, and I thought, he's right, I'm too good for roadie. Beach Boys sat Brian Wilson. I was with him last night. Mike Love sacked him after the end of the tour. Now, you had just sacked Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, but effectively, contractually, I'm guessing now, Mike owns the touring Beach Boys now.
Right.
Because their band was various musicians over the years, and Brian's band were a Beach Boys tribute band that he saw and thought, these are incredible, and he hired the band. And right. I sat with Noddy Oldham in a curry house in Birmingham, as you do, because it's curry. And he just left Slade, and I said, well, look, you know, and at the time, they weren't allowed to work as Slade, and then I think they originally allowed them to use the name Slade 2.
We're already rolling, so if you want to...
I'll say what I think I am. My name's Barry Tones, and I like to think of myself as a kid from a council estate having a go, and I'm still having a go 53 years later. I'm just getting paid for it now. We did talk money, didn't we?
Yeah. Coming out
of the car.
So looking and doing a bit of research on you, first and foremost, before you went travelling the world, jet setting, you're a builder.
Yeah.
15-year-old builder.
Yeah, well, I started building when I was about 8, helping my brother. From 12, I was earning some money doing a builder, but at 15, I started my own building business. I became self-employed when nobody knew what self-employed was, what self-employed mean. This is 50-odd years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that, and I had that company for about 20 years. But for part of it, for 10 years, I was working with Lulu, driving a Rolls Royce in the day, getting home after the gigs at 3:30 in the morning, because she lived in London. I had to drop her home at Compton Avenue in London, and I come back to Birmingham, get in the van, blue and white van with a hole in the wing, you put your fist through, because the vans used to have rusty holes there, right?
Yeah.
And I'd go off to work building, and then back on the night, back down the road. So I did the two, and it was only really in the end, because I was never meant to be in showbiz. I was a kid, I was a grafter. 8 kids in the family, and you have to fight for everything. You fight for the biggest meal, the biggest sausage, if you're on telly, on whatever. So that made me have that sort of forceful power. And right from the age of 8, I was selling firewood around the neighbourhood. I was selling broken licorice to make money. Press studs. I was 8, and at that time, they just liked my dimples and thought, oh, he's 8, I'll buy it. You know, I'm not sure they bought press studs off me because they needed press studs.
So you kept coming out and wake up to an arch.
So that worked in conjunction, but for some reason, somehow, and I don't know how, but I know it's still happening, the music business and the media business just absorbed me, liked me, and wanted me to stay. So in the end, I did take on a couple of builders, but I thought, look, I've got amazing reputation as a builder. I'll need to come back to this when the showbiz packs up, thinking it would after 12 months. I wanted to keep my reputation, so I closed the business. And funny enough, many years later, I've still done 2 or 3 quite big jobs for people. So the Daily News was a Birmingham paper. I had a centre page, but former builder Barry celebrates 10 years with the Stars. Well, that's 43 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was an era of Birmingham Midlands people at that time, wasn't it?
And it still is. And the only people that don't shout loud enough about Birmingham people are Birmingham people. I go to America frequently. I just did my 63rd trip there. I filmed 6 TV shows in April, just going into May. And they call this Rock City. They can't believe I'm from Birmingham. I remember being at a Gibson Guitar Center once, and we were talking about Roy Wood. And ELO and various things like that. And he said, hang on, mate, I've just can I shake your hand? I said, yeah, I'd love to meet you. If you're ever in England, come to Birmingham, have a cup of tea. as we do. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm never going to wash my hand again. I said, why? It was because I'd shook Roy Wood's hand. He shook my hand 30 years later and like, couldn't believe it. Roy could have been a major world star, which he is in the sense of the band, but yeah. In America he could have cleaned up. He just never seemed to go. He went and they did stuff. I know. I think they did like Whiskey Go Go. I think they did Five Nights there as the back as the move. I think
he went as himself.
Yeah. Well, if he'd have gone as himself, he's so revered as a musician, as all of them. You know, Steve Winwood and Joan Armatrade, and it goes on and on and on and on. Mm. So I'm a proud Brummie, but I shout about Birmingham. You know, I was showing you the CDs earlier. Every time I put out a promotional CD to send to record companies around the world, it had some image of Birmingham. And then the one that Brian Wilson was holding up recently in a picture in the media was the Birmingham Music Network one, which I did. And, you know, they loved it, and he loved it, and he played the band. He said, this band reminds me of Early Beach Boys. And we got a press article for that, you know.
Right.
So I'm still just having a go.
Yeah.
You wouldn't tell anybody, will you? This ain't going out tonight.
It's done.
No one watches it.
So what do you make of the debacle of Station Street and everything going on right now? It's all falling into disrepair, isn't it? The Crane pub, Black Sabbath are here in a couple of weeks, yeah, aren't they? The pub's on its arse, isn't it? The Electric Cinema.
It's a joke. That's all of that's a joke. And I did a lot of seminars at Birmingham Library, and I got Birmingham Council. I said, look, you've got to listen to me very carefully. This is 20 years back. I said, we have to have a museum in Birmingham for music. Well, why do you want that? Well, because we have to. Did you get this? And I got one council that went quite far to the point. Number one, Broad Street, which I think now one of the colleges have taken over. Mm. We tried to get that building, which the library were involved. It was closed for years. It was an ex-bank. And I wanted that as a museum. And we got to the point where what I wanted to do was have a stage so bands could play, but all around the edges, we were going to have all the frontages, the old Rum Runner, all the old, you know, Elbow Room and all the venues. Because people come to Birmingham still looking for Duran Duran's first gig, and they do. And I meet people around the world. So I think we've absolutely, you know, failed miserably as a city to do that. It was interesting listening to Sharon the other day that Ozzy's exhibition's come in here, and it's all his own stuff which they've had in store, and I think they're going to do that, aren't they, just before the gig starts. Then after the gig, it's going to build. I think it's just Ozzy's stuff to start with, right. But all of that stuff's going. And she said, you know, we were asked to do Wembley for the final gig. She said, why? We've got no connection with Wembley. Mm. You know, he's from Aston. He's nick a bottle of HP sauce from the old factory, you know. So I think it's a disgrace. I think council after council have really never grasped the value of music to money to the city.
Well, look at that compared to not Liverpool. Yeah.
Exactly. We've got two bands. Yeah. Still a Black in the Beatles. Really. Oh, no, there's a couple of others. Yeah. But we've got
Liverpool
38.
Thrive on that, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. We've got 38. Mm. Now, whenever people come to England from America in particular, but other places, and we're taking them around, right, they all say, want to go to Abbey Road and we want to go to the Cavern.
Yeah.
Two or three will say, we want to go to Birmingham because we're a big fan of Magnum or some of the other bands. Blackfoot Sioux only had one hit record. They were from Birmingham.
Yeah.
And they've got fans around the world. And I said, well, we can take you. But apart from the Black Sabbath bench, very much.
Take on the number 11.
Yeah. Yeah, go on the number 11 route.
That's
my request. I think, I'll say, look, you can get on for £3 now. All day tickets, I think it is, whatever. So,
it is. It's criminal, isn't it?
So I think it's been criminal because tourism is a big income anywhere in the world. Music and film tourism is huge. So, I mean, even Bradford have got a museum for film and television. So why don't we? There is no city in the world, if you get statistics, that has as many international stars and all genre than Birmingham. Nowhere. I mean, you'll Philadelphia, there's a few, or Bruce or whatever, and then you'll get some will have come from, you know, say Chicago. None have got. Anyway, you do the list, check the list, you'll find 38 straight away. You know, we all talk about Duran Duran, UB40, obviously Move, Roy Wood, Wizard and all that. But there's so many. Mm. A huge stars that come from me. It's incredible, really. Mm. Yeah, absolutely incredible.
Yeah. We'll wait for him to say the priest.
What's he doing now? Leave him. He's making out my voice. Yeah. He just put me in my
throat. Right, your bank account. So just to go back then, so is it right then? So you literally, I read that you were a T-Rex fan, but you were seeing someone that was an Albert Stiles fan.
She was a T-Rex fan, and that's why we met, because her mum introduced us. She was an Albert Stiles fan, and she said to me, I've got us tickets to go and see Alvin Stardust at a TV show. And I said, at the time, 16 and a half, 17, why would we go to a TV show? We've got a TV in the living room. He says, only one. We've got one. We've got seven now, but you know.
Yeah.
And she said, well, we get to see him live. And I said, oh, where is it, Manchester? Because I'm building and I'm really busy and self-employed. I said, well, it's Manchester. She said, the only thing is, and the coach was like £2.60 or something. She said, it doesn't finish till 10 and we don't, the last coach leaves at like 10:15, so we might not make the last coach. I thought, oh, that's nice, staying the night in Manchester with my girlfriend. Oh. Sounds good.
Yeah.
So we did. Wasn't as romantic as I thought, because we sat on a freezing cold bench at Piccadilly Station till 6 in the morning. But that's how I met. Afterwards, she said, look, I really want to meet Alvin. I said, well, we're going to get to meet him here. I was amazed how small the studio was, because you see Top of the Pops on the telly, yeah, like that. But I was fascinated as a builder how quick they changed the sets. Alvin had come on, or something had come on. 2 minutes commercial, bosh, new stage. That fascinated me more than the music. But it was great to see that. I was not an Alvin Stiles fan at the time. Great to see the music, great to see it live. And then afterwards, she said, look, we're going to stay and see him. I said, well, they're going to kick us all out. And literally, a TV studio in them days, very unionised, a lot of money was involved. So when it finished, within 25 minutes, that studio was stripped. All the chairs were put away. So thank you very much. Good night, everyone. Make your exit. There's the exit over there. They're all going to the exit. We're standing there. The chairs are being pulled down. And because we didn't join the exodus, people must have thought we weren't there. And she said, well, how do we get to see Alvin? I said, well, I don't know. It's just doors. I don't know. I said, yeah, security guard over there. I'll go and ask him. This big guy, Alvin. I said, excuse me, mate. I said, I'd like to ask. My girlfriend wants an autograph for Alvin. So I said, is there any chance? And I thought he was going to say, you know, do one, son. Tap, tap, tap the door. The door opens. There's Alvin Stiles, now changed because he's finished, in a red poncho, gloves, rings, all the stuff on. And I've got a recording. I actually have an MP3 record because we had a cassette player with us, which was this big. We took him. And he gave me a set of pair of gloves, which I still got, which he signed, a necklace with a star on. And we left and we froze to death in Piccadilly and... that was about as sexy as it got. So that blew my idea of a romantic night out. We came back and I was a builder and I thought, well, that's interesting. I enjoyed that. Really loved the set. And it's never stopped since then. A week later, we get a phone call. Jenny, I met you at Alvin Stiles' gig. She said, well, I didn't like to say then. She said, but that day, I'd only just started working for Alvin as his PR. She said, I work for Wimbledon and for the Milk Race. I know nothing about Alvin Stiles or his music, but my company have put me in charge. You two are clearly big fans. Would you like to come and see Alvin? And would you, you know, and just help me? I said, well, what would you need? She said, well, we're in Stoke-on-Trent at the Steam Machine next Saturday. And we've got a lunchtime show. And don't worry, I've checked with the phones. I've checked with you. Get the train, get this. I'll pick you up at the station. And so I said, Mommy's all right if I go to Stoke-on-Trent, you know, just, yeah, well, if it's on, you know, just be careful.
If you must.
Yeah. I mean, so I go to Stoke-on-Trent, I mean, long before Robbie Williams made Stoke-on-Trent famous, I'll have you know. We go and we get picked up by this Jenny we'd only met briefly at this TV show. She's got a GT6, which was great because it made my girlfriend have to sit on my lap. I thought, more romance. Not exactly banging in the edge, you know. So my idea of romance at 17 did not come off, I tell you. I'm still trying to figure it out.
That,
trying to figure it out. I knew there was something happening, but I just wasn't getting it, really. And now it's weird because we were taken into this hotel, which to me was Buckingham Palace in Stoke-on-Trent, and Alvin was there and he got up and gives a hug, and there were some famous football players, I think from Stoke, I would have thought at the time, and a local BBC DJ, I think it was. And we all had this dinner and we had this lunch. And then we were took to the gig, and then we then were selling posters and t-shirts. Well, I'd never seen so much cash in my life. I mean, I was a builder, I didn't mind the old cash in the hand, like, but this was cash in a box. Selling t-shirts, badges, everything. And so that, again, we did it. I said, oh, you know, do you always do your shows in the day? She said, oh, no, we've got another show here tonight. I said, oh, brilliant, we can stay then. She said, you can't. What do you mean, can't stay? Well, you're not 18. What's that got to do with it? It's a pub, club, you can't stay. Well, we were gutted. We'd seen this show, we'd met Alvin, had all these things. We'd sold all these posters and badges, we were given everything. Again, we come back on the train, absolutely elated, and I thought, it was great. I enjoyed that. You know, it was like a day at the races or a day down blues watching a game, you know. But it, from there, he just rocketed. We finished up running his fan club because it was run by Todd Slaughter, who also run the Elvis Presley fan club. Until now, it's still running, that is, although Todd's not well. And he'd run Alvin's fan club for a bit, and fan clubs were big money then, really. But literally, it was a case of, you know, I'm too busy to do it. So we went and met Todd Slaughter. I mean, a builder from Birmingham, for Brummie. Hello, Todd, how you doing, mate? How's Alvis? Is he all right? Give him our best. Can we have your list, you know? Typical Brummie. Can we have your list? He said, what do you mean? Well, Alvis said, you're shutting the fan club down. You've got a list. He gave us. He said, absolutely. And we then launched Alvin Stardust Info from my mum's house in Norfield, in Lower Beaches Road. And we did that for a few years. And I did PR for Alvin. Begged him to let me do roading. He said, no, you're too good for roading. And I did roading for a week, and I thought, he's right, I'm too good for roading. No disrespect to roading, because without them, they're the answer. It was just, well, I'd stopped drinking at 15. I'd done all the nightclubs in town from 12. Seriously? Yeah. I'd done all the nightclubs in town, like Barbarella's and all that. I was 12 going in the nightclubs. And but my dad died of cirrhosis of the liver, and he was, you know, like the pop. And my dad didn't stop me. It wasn't because he died of cirrhosis of the liver through drinking. I wanted to buy a car, and on our last out of school, we spent a lot of money on booze. And I thought, I had a car. Now, I'll tell you how old I am. I know I only look about 32, but I like to be honest. It's still my brummie. My first car cost £87.50, an advert in the Evening Mail, and a gallon of petrol was 32 pence. A gallon, not a litre. That's how old I am. So we were out of booze, and I thought, I'm not doing this. I want a car. You know, I want a car the day I can have a car. And I never drank again. I've never drank since that day. And of course, in the business I'm in, it's all come across the table. A lot of talcum powder floats about, you know, where we work.
That's amazing going on.
And that funny smelling drink stuff, never touched it, which has been brilliant for me in my career. And
how do you find then that you're in certain situations and you've got the upper end of the kind of the overs, like getting to the Greek a little bit, where
100%, yeah. And it's been a great thing. I remember Lula, she said, we love you, Barry, because you don't drink, you don't smoke, and you don't chase girls. I said, well, I do chase girls. I can never catch up.
Maybe if you drank it a bit quicker.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. No, I thought it was quick, but it was, I mean, I've seen a lot, and I could write, I mean, the Sun have offered me a lot of money over the Usford stories, but I want to talk stories about all the fun stuff I did, but I'm not going to reveal secrets.
Is that an unwritten code of promoters? Yeah. And
well, it is, because I remember getting offered, the News of the World offered me £17,000 to talk a story about Lulu, and all it was very simple. Lulu and John Frieda split up, her husband. They wanted someone close to them that could have a good story or a bad story. I said, well, I don't even want to tell a good story. And I spoke to them, and they offered me 17 grand, and that's a long time ago, 20 odd years ago, because the News of the World paid that sort of money. And all I was going to say, look, you know, whenever I went to Lulu and we left her house in London, I'd drive, and we had five cars, a Merc, a Porsche, a Mini, a BMW. My favourite car was a Merc 450 SEL, and that's what we used most of the gigs. So I would drive off the drive and drive to the top of the road, and there's a Ringo Starr lived here, Lulu. There's only six houses in the road. And then there was my Ford Cortina, 666 HDL, parked in there. I said, it's vintage. And that only had six houses. And at the top, there was a barrier, a security barrier. So I would drive up to the barrier, and she would walk up hand in hand with John. He'd give her a kiss, and she'd get in the car. Lovely story, but I wasn't willing to reveal it. I just wasn't going to do it, because they, you know, they wanted to just find stuff. So I've turned down a lot of money for stories, but I've made a fortune out of stories, because they're not my clients, and clients come to me with stories, and people say, well, how is it, you know, it's the truth. I'm not bothered. It's their truth. It's not my truth. Yeah. I'm going to go to the publisher. They're going to decide if it's legal or not legal to publish it. None of it's my truth, because there always is your truth, my truth, and the truth. If somebody pays for it, they pay for it. So I've had a lot of massive press over this, and that's where I mostly make my money these days, as a publicist, really.
So you're just talking, fast forwarding a little bit, but you had COVID.
Before it really was a thing, yeah. We'd all heard about this thing in China, but there was always a virus in China, and you know, Ebola and different things. So we'd heard about it. I went to America, and the TV presenter, Monica Price, I went out there with, she said, oh, we need to be a bit careful, don't we? I said, well, not really, it's China, we're in America. Lo and behold, we land in Los Angeles, LAX. Air China is the plane next to us. 250 Chinese come through, and they're sneezing all they're doing all this. And I never could have thought and looked at the airport. Nobody had masks on. There was no restrictions. Nobody talked about it. 3 days later, I went down like a ton of bricks, and still not thinking the word COVID. Still not thinking that. I said, look, we've got to get home. And obviously, if I'd have had COVID, I probably wouldn't have been allowed on the plane. But no, there was no restriction. So we came home very, very ill, very ill. And I went into my house and I walked through the door and I just collapsed. And then I was seriously ill. But and that was the week then that Boris said, you've got to stay at home. Mm-hmm. We've got a problem. So I'd already got it and I'd had it, but then I'd had it for 6 weeks and I refused to go to hospital. I said, I've got stuff to do, I can't go to hospital. And, you know, several times, you know, we're going to have to call an ambulance. Now I'm not going to hospital. So the one night, and this is about 6 weeks in, and COVID as an infection is about 10 days.
Yeah.
But I'm still getting the after effects now. My legs don't work now, 5 years later, properly. So the one night I walk up the stairs and I'd not been able to get upstairs for 2 or 3 weeks. But I'd attempted to get upstairs to bed. And then all of a sudden I thought, what was that? Felt like I'd been hit with a lump hammer on my back. And I said to my wife, I said, you better go on ambulance. This is different. She was shocked because the ambulance came in all asthmatted up, whisked me off to hospital. She never expected to see me again. Because that, what does that mean? Everybody was going and either on a ventilator or down the chute, you know, whatever it was. So I was in hospital with pneumonia and the person there in the bed, look, how did I get here? Don't you know your wife called you? Look, sir, you've already got a lung infection. You're actually not going to make it through the night. We'll get you the phone, call your wife. Okay. Same conversation. The girls weren't just in masks, they were in asthmat suits that's down at the QE. And I'm like, I couldn't sit. And she gave me morphine, but down my throat, like a liquid. And I was like, Jesus, you know. So I don't drink used to taste, you know. It was a vial. And then they give me some paracetamol. And they, you know, again, there was people coming in all the time. And we got away. And I kept hearing this. And he said, you know, you're probably not going to make the night. Do you want to make a phone call now? Nobody can come and see you. I'm texting, thinking I haven't got a charge on my phone. I'm texting my wife. I said, you better tell Tara in the hospital, but don't tell her why. Just say, you know, I had an injury or something. And then she said, what are you going to do? I said, we're going to find you a bed. I said, well, what about all these? You know, these? She said, no, we're going to find you a bed because we can save you. And I'm like, and I said, I'll tell you what then, I'm going home. Mm-hmm. Give one other person a chance. And she said, well, do you mind not going till 10 o'clock tomorrow because we wanted the consultant to see you, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he did. And he said, well, I don't think you should go home. I said, look, if I'm going to die, I'd rather die in my own bed. I said, but if you could only save 1 in 10, have a go at somebody else. Mm-hmm. I'll take my chances. And I run outside the hospital. I'd only got like a vest on and some tracks. I don't know, I kind of had flip flops or something. Freezing cold outside. And I remember ringing home and my wife drove down there, nearly crashed the car driving fast because she never thought she'd see me again. And I was ill then for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, you know. But still kept trying to do so. Radio stations called me. Then the press found out it went in the paper, even in an American newspaper. Well, somebody in Tallahassee need to know what I've got. But they did 15 people from America and one from England, so it was me.
What did you say when your life
flashed? Yeah, so
when your life flashed before your eyes.
Yeah. You have a moment like that, where you've got to reflect on life and kind of think about the things you've done. So at any point, did you regret in that time your involvement with Right Said Fred's On Too Sexy?
Well, I was, because they were sexy. I mean, they were very sexy and still are. Well, I was having a problem with my romance. Well, no, you know, I got on the coach, finished up on the bench. Lula said, you don't chase girls. I said, well, I do actually, is that all right, you know? So I was actually thrilled because we made I'm Too Sexy. We had a plug-in company called Station to Station, and we got that in the charts to number two, and it stayed at number two for many, many weeks. So we made a shilling. So
I understand.
Absolute classic.
Well, I understand as well, it's the first UK song to go number one in the US.
That's right, absolutely right, yeah, and they were huge, and they are still huge. I mean, they had the Deeply Dippy, I think, went to number one as well. But incredible musicians, just for some reason it was novelty records, but I'm Too Sexy brings them in a couple of million a year. It's in so many adverts and films around the world. And even, I think it was Beyonce, did a version, used a piece of it, and they get co-write, made another shilling.
Right.
So, you know.
You know what, that was another one of my questions, actually, because obviously you've had a relationship with Slade.
Yeah, absolutely.
Slade, as we all know, every year, they the Jack
Mel Christmas,
don't they? So who of your artists that you've dealt with in that? Who does bring in the most royalty, or which song which side brings in the most return royalties?
I suppose probably in the sense Slade, because with Slade, a 50-year-old song, you're still bringing in about $500,000 a year for the writers. And you've got to bear this in mind, it's only for the writers. Dave and Don never got a shilling. And really? I sat with Noddy Older in a curry house in Birmingham, as you do, Christmas curry. Yeah. And he just left Slade. And I said, well, look, you know, and at the time they weren't allowed to work as Slade. And I also did a record, which I'll talk a little bit about, with Dave Hill for the Queen Mum on my record label, Gotham Records. So I said, look, Nudge, you know, Dave ain't making the money like you guys. You've got to let him do the tour. And there was a lot of infighting for a couple of years. And then I think they originally allowed them to use the name Slade 2, which was Don and Dave, and they called it Slade 2.
Right.
And then it went on, and then they re-released all the stuff. I remember being with him when they got to re-release all the CDs. I was with Nod again, and he said, look, you know, we've got to let them earn money, and they carried on. And I think he's about to do the final gigs, Davies, I think. They're saying this is the last Christmas tour, but a lot of them said that, even Gary Glitter. With his case, it was, they locked him up. He couldn't make a comeback on him.
That has rough,
really. Yeah, absolutely. So probably Slade, but I work with a lot of people, I've been associated with a lot of people, and you people like your Led Zeppelins, and I, you know, do bits with Robert Plant, and his new band's incredible, you know, Saving Grace are just amazing. They do bring in the millions, because in the 70s, in the 60s, managers managed the Cliff Richards and the Shadows and all that stuff, and Cilla Black, but the managers took the money and paid the artists a salary often. Yeah. So the managers kept the bulk of the money. Then when he came into the 70s, I remember Robert Plant said to me, he said, look, he said, we didn't know what we were doing. He said, we were just in the right place, the right time. Everything was flying. And it's only really the 70s up to the end of the 70s that bands really made the big money, all the bands that were touring.
Is that everyone was too high and hallucinogenic?
Yeah, well, nobody knew where the money was. That was the problem. They forgot where they left it. Nobody can remember what they signed and what they didn't sign. There's all this funny smelly stuff. I don't get it myself.
Surely on a yellow submarine or something.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So Slade are a good example. And I've always said to my young bands and all the bands, start try and write a Christmas song, because even if it's just, it could just be successful in a small way. You could have a, like one of my artists did a thing called Three Kings, which is a Spanish, they're into the Three Kings. I said, you have a hit in Spain, it's going to come back every year. So I would always advise that. But in terms of the richest people I've worked with, it's probably going to be the Lulus. I mean, Alvin made a lot of money, but was never a multimillionaire. I did do a lot of where we go. We literally made a lot of money for a very small time. But there are, you know, I've got artists and friends from the 60s had one hit record, and they still get about 50 grand a year. So they've got a salary,
fine,
a reasonable salary from a song 40 years ago because they wrote it. So anybody out there, any musician, try and write songs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Please try and write songs. That's where the money is, you know.
Can we talk about the Beach Boys? How did you manage to get them?
Well, I've heard of him.
Yeah.
That was weird. I'd been working with Alvin. And Alvin introduced me. Alvin's manager introduced me to Lulu because I worked on the Let's Rock TV series at ATV. Lulu didn't. Lulu already had a tour manager, and I've just become really friendly with her. She was down there. She then said to me, a manager called me and said, oh, Barry, you know, we've obviously got two managers, but he's ill today. Could you do one gig for us? You know, that's how I finished up with Lulu. And then the first ever gig, I drove from Birmingham to London, picked Lulu up, drove to Stockton-on-Tees, 6.5 hours, did a gig, drove Lulu to London and drove home. 27 hours, I got 20 quid.
Right.
But I was driving Lulu's car. I was with Lulu. The money's never mattered. It's never mattered to me. Well, I signed on the dole all the time, so I got that money, didn't I? I was never bothered what they paid me. I just kept signing on, getting the Benjamins, you know. Not a problem. So Lulu then got invited to South Africa, and I said, I got a call, can we go? I said, yeah, of course. They said, Barry, it's all over Christmas. I said, that's fine, not a problem, Christmas, New Year. And that was with the Beach Boys, and that's how I met the Beach Boys. And then I'd become quite good friends with the Beach Boys, and for a good 40 years after I was at gigs. And then Brian left the Beach Boys. I mean, when he was with the Beach Boys then, he was huge. I mean, he was massive, and he was still having his illness, and he wasn't really with it. And I don't think the piano was mic'd up. But if they had him on stage, they got £1 million for the gigs in South Africa, you know. So we did that. And then he got a lot better, and his new wife got him back out singing, and I was friends of the band. So I went to Brian Wilson gigs many times over the 30 years. Then he rejoined the Beach Boys for the 50th anniversary tour, about 2012, I think. And I remember the after show party at Wembley, the last night of the 50th anniversary tour, they'd recorded a new album, brilliant, all great, it's nice to see him back with the Beach Boys. And the next day I'd get up, and the first thing I do every morning, 5 o'clock, I get every paper. That's my job, I'm a publicist. Daily Mail, Beach Boys sat Brian Wilson. I was with him last night. Mike Love sacked him after the end of the tour. Now, you had just sacked Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, but effectively, contractually, I'm guessing now, Mike owns the touring Beach Boys now.
Right.
Because their band was various musicians over the years. And Brian's band were a Beach Boys tribute band that he saw and thought, these are incredible. And he hired the band.
Right.
And they toured with Brian Wilson for 15, 20 years.
Wow.
And he did the Smile album, 45 years later. And of course, tragically, we've got to say Brian died last week. And I was really honoured that people called me just for a few words and I talked about it. And there's the CD that we were showing earlier. There's a picture of me with Brian. And this is, I'm always promoting Birmingham. That was the Birmingham CD I did. And Brian's holding it up at a gig. And, you know, great times. I mean, amazing stuff. Again, I could tell a load of stories. But why would you? You know?
Yeah. You know? So I'd seen... So just on that at the time, the Beatles and the Beach Boys were a friendly rivalry.
Totally, yeah.
So who on a car park in Northfield would have come out on top?
Oh, Beach Boys. Beatles are not that good. Honestly, I know, people are throwing things at the screen. I do apologise. The Beatles were not that great. They were a good live band. I don't think the songs were like... The Kinks were better, far better band. The Beatles together for about 12 years, right? And, you know, Paul McCartney hasn't written a hit song in 60 years. So, personally... Every time I'd have took the Beatles, I'd have took Cilla Black over the Beatles personally, because I've never rated them, which is, and it does cause a lot of controversy. But the Beach Boys, what happened with Brian, they'd done Pet Sounds, which Paul McCartney said made us the best band we could ever be because we wanted to emulate that.
Yeah.
Well, Brian had done the Smile album, which was an incredible album, advanced 50 years advanced really for its time. But when he heard Sgt. Pepper, he shelved it. And it was only this new band that he found some years ago. Said, look, you know, we read about Smile Album. Where's it? Well, I don't know. They got bits. Well, they'd learned it all. And they went in and re-recorded and did the full album and released it probably 10, 15 years ago. And Paul McCartney was at that gig in London. I think we did 3 nights, I think it was. And Paul said, the best song ever written, ever, is God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. Brian... you know, he had a breakdown, and it's well documented. I'm not really anything. He had a breakdown. People believed he had a breakdown because he didn't think he was good enough after he heard the Beatles. And yet the Beatles were in awe of him, as are a lot of people. You know, so I don't quite know if you sack Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, but if you're Brian Wilson, who cares?
So how then? How do we go from dealing with huge international superstars to pivoting into reality stars, and what do the what kind of challenges and what kind of nuances does that throw up?
Is it much of the same?
No, a completely different world. Totally different world. I'm a music fan. I don't play music, I play no instruments, I don't write songs. I am a music fan. So when I hear a new song, I don't say, oh, the bass is a bit low, or the hi-hats too. It's good or it's bad in its genre. So that's why I was drawn to music. Anyway, 20 years ago, I was at a new music seminar in New York, probably more than 20 years ago, and I was in Lulu's brother, not connected to Lulu, I just bumped into him. And I said, hello, mate, how are you doing? He said, I've just been in this room here. He said, now I had a Barclay card at the time. I mean, since then, there's done thousands of cards, right? The old-fashioned Barclay card. And he said, I just went in a room, and they put this card, like a Barclay card, in the machine, and it played music. I went, seriously? So the beginning of digitization, and I thought, when I launched my own record label in 1987, we had cassettes, we had 7-inch single, 12-inch single, and CDs. It was very expensive to launch a song because you had to cover the formats. So I thought, 8-track before as well. That didn't really take off as much. And I thought, there ain't no future in a record company. Now, as a record company, you made up stories, you elaborated on stories. Like when a band had come to me and say, we're a new band, we've got a single out. I said, yeah, but nobody cares about the single. What's the story? Where did you go to school? Oh, I went to school in West Brom. Right, what school? Oh, yeah, okay, Robert Plant went to that school. So what you're going to say is, when I was a kid at school, Robert Plant still revered around that school, and I got this impression that I wanted to be the next Robert Plant, and I decided to form a band. Nothing to do with Robert Plant. Years later, but the press would use Robert Plant in the story, which meant it would get printed. And I thought, well, she's easy. And then suddenly, I think I got like 50 quid for summer. 50 quid for a story. Well, now I can get 15 grand for a front page of the Sun. So then, because of that, the whole music industry changed. DJs became the pop stars in the 80s, and that they were big rock stars. That was who people paid an absolute fortune for. And then as I'd seen a lot of reality TV in America, because I've been back and forth in America, and I thought that's going to come to England eventually. And the things like the Big Brothers and all that came. And I did Celebrity Big Brother, all those sort of things. And I quickly realised that people would believe what you tell them. And I even did a TV show with Nick Knowles about that. We faked him as a pop star. And so I then started approaching a few of them. Now, the problem, what was brilliant for about a year, everybody that was in Big Brother and all that, were natural, and they were normal, and they did their thing, and oh, he's funny, he's cute, oh, he's mad, she's a nutter. A year later, everybody pretended to do those things. So it was never as good, but the press knew it made money. So when I decided to go down the reality star route, what I realised, I had to say to every one of them, this is my pedestal. I'm going to put you on it, cross me, and I'm knocking it from under your feet. And I was right, because they'd be a nobody. You'd invent some story about them, you know, waking up on a sunbed, finding that, you know, so-and-so famous was sitting next to them, blah, blah, blah. And as long as there was a tiny modicum of reality and truth in the story, I always describe PR as an elastic band. You put an elastic band on your finger, it's an elastic band. Stretch it, it's still an elastic band. And that's what PR is. As long as there's one small connection, you can make it huge. And I did, believe me. I've had a boy with no skin, Moyne, who was a big Villa fan, well known here, represented him. White D, rock star in her own way, shouting, screaming down the street wherever we went. You know, I had a guy born with a penis, and they made him a real penis from skin from his arm. But seriously, so anything that was outrageous, I was down there, and I got front page of the Sun with that.
Yeah, I saw you took management of the Octomom.
We bought her a horse. We bought her a horse because everybody go mad.
Mechanic horse.
If the car broke down, you go home on a horse. What's the matter with you? Have you not heard of a horsepower? How many horsepower? Okay, you don't know what to do. You need to get a co-presenter. I did stuff with Marie for about 10 years. And it was funny because she'd done something and White Dick, and she'd got out this girl. So White said, the press all at the door. What, I didn't even know that. And I met her, and she had 8 kids, and she was on benefits. And the problem was with the benefit system, and it still is with the benefit system, it stops you working. It's not easy to say, I've got a week's work. Can we just stop my benefits for that week, and I'll earn my money? And then men, and they still haven't got that right. They're off their heads. So I then found that a lot of legals, and especially when we start with D, I went to the DWP, I said, look, I'm taking this girl on. I have no idea if it's going to make any money. I have no idea at all. But I want you to know, from today, February the 12th, I'm going to be representing her. And if it makes any money, I'm going to declare it. And you can decide then how best you deal with it. Well, it was in the Houses of Parliament, David Cameron said, we've got to stop this girl, this white deal on benefits. We've got to stop it. You idiot. We'd stopped the benefits 6 months before. And then there was an investigation, and the DWP wanted to meet me to talk about it. Because I said, and the only reason happened, I was on WM, and I was talking to an MP, and he accused me of getting people on benefits so I could get commission from the benefits, which was great. That was the thing I was guilty of, really. But he accused me of getting them on benefits knowing I'd get a commission. Well, I love that. Call me what you like, do anything you like, spell my name right, because that gets me doing. So then I got a call from the DWP, we really do need to meet you about White Day. I said, it's September. He said, that's right. I said, what about my letter in February and my letter in March? You've never replied. And I said this on the radio. They called me up. Right, I'll come to the DWP. No, we don't want you meeting us. What do you mean, we don't want you meeting us? You just said you want to meet me. No, we're not. We don't. You don't come in here. We don't want the press turning up. I said, well, what do you suggest then? She said, well, we'll meet you. I said, okay, will you meet me? So they came to my house. My house had got a 7-foot walk around it, big 14-foot gates, to my little castle. I go in there and clean the dog shit up and whatever, and I'm told to wash up. That's my real world. I just go inside and become this brat, you know. So they came, and I thought, F you, you're not doing that. I called the Daily Mail, and I called the Daily Mail and said, you might want to park in this road and get a picture. Well, I was doing loads with the press. If I'd have said stand on your head twice for 2 hours, they'd have done it. Daily Mail sent a photographer, parked across the road from the house. They get out the car, we open the doors, and you can get 3 cars into my drive, then you can drive in the gate. Well, I made them park outside the gates because I wanted this picture. And we got a picture, and then they got out the car. I said, yeah, have you brought this photographer with you? I said, how dare you bring them to my house? This is my private dwelling. So then I went to I think it was Morrison's, to meet my 90-year-old uncle for a cup of tea afterwards. And I'm on the phone outside, and the next day it appears in papers, Barry Tones meets the DWP at Morrison's. Nothing at all to do with it. But I thought, you just gotta play the game. And I have, and I did. And I've made a lot of people a lot of money. But with the reality stars, they suddenly get a reality check, because I say, let me tell the story, because I'm good at it. Let me take the bit that we've got to have, the truth bit, let me enhance the story. And they do for a bit, but then they get too big for the boots, and they tell you. And I say, well, how much do you charge a month for a publicist? What do you mean? Well, how much do you get as a publicist? Well, nothing. Well, I get $3,500 a month from people, so let me do my job and you do yours. And I've earned people 70 quid, grand, 150 grand over time. So for a kid from Norfield, that, you know, I'm still claiming benefits now. Don't mention that. Well, you got to, ain't you? You know, my dad paid him.
Well, I'd seen one of the articles where you were talking to someone about that, I think with D, you were saying it should be, it's cost you 100 grand, it should be something that you're looking at return investment, bringing 500 grand in if things go well.
Yeah.
Did that go the way you wanted it to go?
Not at all. But, you know, that's the problem. They blew their money on being idiots. When I said, look, you've just got more money, like Celebrity Big Brother's a good example. I won't reveal them out because it's private, but it was enough money to pay 3/4 of a house, and there you have got a house for the rest of your life. But they didn't. They blew the money. They all blew the money on trying to be self-important or getting their, and not in Dee's case, but getting their lips done or getting their arses enlarged. Well, I'll enlarge your arse, I'll kick it. That'll get bigger. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I found it was another world. And then also, it's probably I don't care if people don't like me. I want them to, because I want them, but I don't care. They're not coming to my house for dinner. I'm not bothered. But it was during that period of about 5 years, well, I got real vitriolic, nasty. I mean, I was reported as a paedophile. I was the paedophile hunters in America were making the TV show following me. Photographers had stormed out of buildings because I'd made them do things. And I'm like, fantastic. The haters make you money. As long as you personally aren't hurt by it. I'm not saying it doesn't offend you. If you're not hurt by it. Well, you know, I'm probably from Gansel State. You know, I was nicking firewood at 8, mate. You know it. So basically, I thought, no, the haters make your money. Eight away, kids. Some of your clients will back off because you've accused of being a paedophile. That's up to them. If they don't believe I am who I am, then I don't want to work with them anyway. So, yeah, so it's an interesting life. And it's funny that I only live 1,000 metres from where I grew up. Totally different world. I've got massive detached house with a big wall around it. And I never spoke to any of the neighbours there for like 30 years because I didn't want to. And it was only COVID. I didn't want nobody to know. But what had happened, I'd come back from America and got this COVID. And normally you'd see stuff all over social media about paving to America, been here, I met him, da, da, da. Well, there was nothing because I was really ill. And a radio station, Black Country Radio, got wind of the hill. Barry's just come back from America. Why is there nothing? And he phoned me. I said, Dave, look, mate. I said, I'm actually very ill. I said, I've got COVID. He said, what? He said, you're joking. He said, you've got to come on and talk about it. I said, Dave, I couldn't get out of my lounge. There's no way I'm coming on. He said, well, look, I think somebody like you could really help the people that are suffering and give them a bit of spirit. I said, look, man, not really. It's not really good. He persuaded me to do it. And then 2 days later, a guy called me and we did an interview on the phone. I never knew or remembered a word I said in that interview. That's how delirious I was. I could have said Villa are better than Blues. You know, I could have been hung. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Do you know what I'm saying? Absolutely. I could have been over it. Could have been, you know, I could have shot firing squad. So I couldn't believe it. They put out the interview, and the funny enough, they delivered it through my letterbox in some little sealed envelope 2 months later. Then the Birmingham Mail got wind of it, so hey, print's a big story. And well, at that point, I told nobody that I'd got COVID. My family didn't know I got COVID. My daughter lived in Norfield. She lived just down about a mile away. She'd been trying. I said, oh, I'm really ill, Don. I can't come. I'm coming. I said, no, you're not coming up, Don. I've got 7 foot cage. You know you can't get in my house. She said, it's not happening. I said, so stay at home. And because I was worried about her getting COVID, but I never said I'd got COVID. So that night when I found out the mail, they called me and said, oh, Barry, just to let you know, tomorrow we're putting out a story about you. I said, oh, brilliant, what have I done now? I said, you got COVID? I said, oh, for fuck's
sake. Irony of all the things I've got to say about you, that's what
niggles most. Well, because I hadn't told my family. So I had to ring my family and say, I've got COVID, don't worry, I'm on the mend. Well, for 30 years, because I've been in the house 36 years, for 30 years, I never spoke to anybody in that road. No, drove in the gates, and they all just think, who's that ponce drives in the gates, shuts the gates, never says hello, comes in and out with all sorts of cars, all time of the night, big 8 foot wall around the garden. Who is he? Never knew. Well, when the COVID thing went in the mail, it turned out that one of the people in the street, we grew up down Low Beaches Road, like 1,000 metres away, and he messaged me on Facebook, said, Barry, I'm really sorry you're ill, do you need anything? I said, no, mate, I'm all right. So then I get a message saying, go to your gate, I've left you something. I go to your gate, left you something. Check the gate, there's a carrier bag, open the carrier bag, paracetamol, tin of soup, face wipes, okay, fair enough. Next day, go to the gate, and so something else. Third day, somebody knitted me a blanket, and they're putting it on my gate. I'm thinking, where's the cash? What's the matter with you people? Cash is killing you. I buy my own blanket from a charity shop in Roodbury, you know. So. And then the funny thing happened, they were getting the funny side of it, and then one said, I've left some outside, you can't see me, for God's sake. So I opened my gate, and there's a mop bucket, a metal mop bucket with holes in it, useless, good as a chocolate fire guard. He said, try and make some out of there, you clever bugger. Well, I made the most amazing Christmas decoration. I drew loads of holes in it, put a bracket in the bottom, hung it upside down with lights hanging out, spectacular. 90 quid at a garden centre, now you can buy that for, right? So I did that, and then, now my daughter, just before I told her I had to say I got COVID because I knew it was going in the paper, she said, you're ill, Dad. Have you got this COVID? Said, no. I said, no, I feel great, darling, honest. And she said, well, how come you not doing any posts? I said, oh, no, I'm just giving a little break. So I went outside in the garden. I said to them, oh, I've got the lawnmower out, put the lawnmower out, and I'm going to start switching off
set.
And we're going to cut grass. So I went, fly mode, and collapsed. But I had a 15-second, me in the garden. Send it to Tara. There you go, Baba, mate in the garden. Oh, Dad, it's good to see you in the garden. She said, did you get much of the grass cut? She realised it was a bit short. I said, yeah. So the next day, we went in the back garden, did the same thing. Collapsed, couldn't stand up. And I sent a couple of things. She said, Dad, I know you're faking it because you ain't posting anything. And you ain't posting these videos. So then I'll post a video. Now, to this point, you're not allowed in my garden. Only Lulu, Alvin, Stardust and Midger have ever been in my house. Right? That's it. All the bit of, you don't come to my house. That's it. When I go home, I get the dog shit up, I do the washing up, and I do as I'm told. But outside the gates, it's my world. So it's really weird because I got to this point where I knew that people were asking about it. So I went in the garden, filmed a little video. I can't remember what it was. And I did film a few inspirational videos in the end, and I got quite a big following because I said, oh, thank God, you know, we just anybody to talk to, we're all going demented. Then somebody said, what's that pelican in the background? It's this big pelican, this tall. I said, oh, my granddad made that 80 years ago. He was a stonemason in Stratford. Oh, any comments? So then I filmed something else in my garden. Well, 6 weeks later, I'm offered a television show. They called me the Garden Picasso. I'm offered a television show in Brighton, latest TV. I said, oh, yeah. Well, in the end, we couldn't do it because it was COVID at the time. Although, as journalists, we could travel. We could travel with our press pass during COVID if we wanted to. They'd been given a load of money by something to do with doing some kind of data thing to do with COVID. And they said, could you be in our film if we come to your house? I said, yeah, no problem at all if you're happy. He said, it's okay. Then they travelled from Brighton separate on a train and one in a car because they couldn't travel together. Came to my house, filmed me talking about being ill, and I hadn't told my daughter, and then it came out about the paper. So we got my daughter to come up, and we sat in the garden. I just burst out crying. I apologised for not telling her because what I'd also said, at one point I didn't expect to live, absolutely didn't expect to live. And I'm on the floor thinking, not going to make it tonight. I better call my daughter in the morning, because I'd remembered these calls in the hospital. So I'm not going to remember it. I'm going to call my daughter. So I go in the morning, I thought, no, I know what I'll do. If I call her now, she'll have a dreadful day and then she'll have a bad night. So I'll call her tonight, she'll have a good day, but still have a bad night. Don't know how that makes sense, but that was what was going on. Yeah. So I picked up the phone several times to say goodbye. And I thought, no, I'll give it one more day, another day. And then about several weeks later, I sipped a bit of soup and fought back. And still got troubles, like my legs are weak now, and I do get a bit of breathing trouble. But enthusiasm, it's not stopped it at all. So she came up, and I apologised to her on this film about, I said, I'm really sorry I didn't tell you. And we were both sat in my garden crying, and they're filming it, and it was lovely television. And so they're there, the crew, and they said, hang on, we were going to do Garden Picasso with you. I said, yeah. TV presenter, changed the clothes, we filmed around my garden. And then I got offered a TV show, but COVID kind of faded a bit. Then it come back a bit. We were going back to a lockdown. So she scheduled, the woman that owned the TV show, I want you to come to my garden and totally transform my garden. We'll film it as a TV show. And I went down, I did drive down with my journalist pass and had a quick look. And I said, well, I've got some great ideas about that. And we never did it because of COVID. But now I've been doing it again. I've been filming stuff now. So I found out after, during about that 6 or 8 months where we really were locked down, I posted 178 videos of me making stuff. And I had no idea, because my Facebook's public, people just, they said, we get up in the morning and we want to see what you're doing. Because every day, you clearly have been ill, but every day you get up. And I, when a kid has a blanket, a comfort blanket, and they chew it, I had a blanket I wouldn't let go. I used to have that blanket around my head.
Not the knitted one that you know
I'm drawing. No, it was crap. Big holes in it. No, it was one of them. I think it was the dog's blanket. The dog got the old. So I'm having your blankets. So I fought back from that. But it was during that time I thought, I'm not going to work so much with reality stars, only because they're only going to get their 15 minutes of fame. But in that 15 minutes, I'm going to give them a lot of fame and probably enough money to do something. 99% of the time, they didn't do anything. And when you said, look, this might not work anymore, you need to do this, I need you to get on a plane to go to Greece because there's a crew over there. What are they paying me? Well, they're not. They're paying for your flight to Greece. They're paying for your travel to the airport. Well, no, they'll have to pay me a fee. No, you go in for a pilot. You go in to record a pilot, you idiot. You don't get paid. I mean, I did amazing stuff and got incredible fees for people. But then I realised it's short-lived. I'm not going to be playing their records in 50 years' time. So I did less. I don't do none, because I did the guy with the actually built a real, he was born without a penis, and they built him a penis. And they actually, doctor said, we're going to take the skin from here. How big do you want it? He said, well, I don't know. Never had one. So, and seriously, I've got the pictures of the scars. It was that big there. And then it had black. The reason he had some particular thing where your bladder's born outside your body, and that's why the penis didn't develop. So when they cut the bladder away, they used some of that. And then there's another guy, and they created him a penis and sewed it to his arm. He had his penis on his arm.
Yeah, I remember that.
Have you seen that? Yeah. Quite a yeah. Long. Well, I got my guy into the papers, and I got a substantial amount of money because I'd done a deal with the Daily Mail. But then I did it with the Sun. We got what we call a splash. I mean, the Lotto grand, I got a splash for a woman from Worcester that claimed she'd won the Lotto, and they're all outside her house. And it was very, very odd because there were 12, 15 press. And what it was, his mum went home one night, said, oh, I've won the lotto. She said, really? So he looked, he said, Mum, it's like 10 million. Yeah, I've won the lotto. He knows the local news agent, so he goes down to the local news agent, ah, Mum's won the lotto, you know. What do you mean? Bought a ticket here, won the lotto. So of course he phones the Sun. The Sun charge up, they all charge up. There's 13 press camped outside her house for 13 days. She did a disappearing act. And this is how bizarre it is, because I'm a kid from a council estate, still having a crack, still signing on, still getting the Benjamins, right? So her best friend had a sister whose husband worked for the Duke of Edinburgh. He was his security.
Right.
She said, is there any way you can advise us? They're mobbing the house, they're in there. We can't go in there. She's terrified because she's told a pack of lies. And is there anything you suggested, you said, what you've got to do, you've got to get yourself a publicist, because the publicist will deal with that. They'll filter it and they'll reduce the numbers and then they'll find one that'll pay you. And she said, well, I don't know, what does a publicist do? The Duke of Edinburgh's bodyguard, who I've never met in my life, there's a guy called Barry Times from Birmingham, find him, he'll do it. And they got my number from, wherever you get my number from, probably down the door, it's on my card at the bottom. And I couldn't believe it, but I found her. I met her in a car park in Upwood, phoned the son, I said, I found her. We've got to get, he said, well, it's Saturday, it's 2 o'clock, we've only got to 5 o'clock to get this theatre. We booked four rooms at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in town. She said, you haven't got no press with you. I said, well, you know you're meeting the son, but it's an exclusive, we can get a load of money for this. So we on the way there, of course, we pull up at the Hyatt Hotel in Broad Street. There's press everywhere. She's going mad. I said, no, hang on. This is no do us. We've got an exclusive with the son. Stay in the car. I figured the Manchester United football team were staying there. So the press were all there. So we went in, sneaked in the room, told a story. We then got 15 grand for the son the next day. I had to take a phone off her, a friend's phone off her. I phoned up Monica, who's the TV presenter I work with. I said, listen, I've got to stay in a hotel tonight with two women. I said, I don't have a lot of luck with women. Would you mind coming up and staying and just being a chaperone? I said, just get in your car. You're in Worcester. She came up. She stayed the night. And then the next day, we got it in the sun. And I said, listen, I've got a great idea for a story on Monday. We'll get more money. We've got the 15 grand. The deal's done. Big splash in the sun. But I want the sun to do the Monday, because that's the crack, is to keep it going. So we went to a laundry, because basically she said she'd washed a ticket in the laundry. That was the story. And she was in her jeans and the code rubbed off, but that's the correct numbers. What she'd really done was bought a ticket the next week with the same numbers that had won, tried to get rid of the code and pretending that was the ticket from the week before, claiming she'd washed it in her jeans. And that was why the press, you know, big liar, blah, blah, blah. Her son, genuinely, he was ordering a motorbike, he thought she'd flip it for. So I said, I've got a great idea. There's a laundry in Harbour. I said, we're going to go to the laundry tomorrow with her. I said, she's going to go in the laundry. Right, I said, but she's going to go and buy a copy of the Sun, because she's in the Sun on the Sunday. I said, what we're going to do is, there's a lotto sign. She can stand under the lotto sign, but we're going to go in with a box of washing powder, ready to wash the ticket. Well, I know that works. And he said, seriously, yeah. So we get to the laundry. Well, we're not allowed to go in the laundry. The Sun can't go in the laundry without permission. And you ain't going to get permission, even if you could find out who owned the laundry. Somebody in Baghdad, probably. You've no idea. So I said, no problem. I said to her, listen, go and buy the ticket, stand underneath there, don't move till you just see me nod my head. Here we go, the picture of you coming out with the son and the lottery ticket. When I open the door, walk in and then turn around. So I went in the laundry, I opened the door, I said, this fucking door won't close. Why won't the door? So I'm holding the door open. What's the door's jammed? There's about four people in there. Well, I knew the man across the road from the Sun could get her picture with the laundrette with the door wide open, like she's in the laundrette. And that made the papers the next day, load of money.
That's class.
And that's how, you got a tiny bit of the truth, because it's important, but then whose truth? Mm. Whose truth?
But the whole time, her son's trying to order things because he genuinely thinks she's...
Yeah, he ordered a motorbike and ordered the stuff. And she was on benefits. I had this same thing with the DWP, on benefits. So all I had to do was just declare the money, and if she didn't declare the money, she goes, I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to declare your money to the DWP, declare it or don't declare it, whatever you want to do, but I'm telling you, I'm going to do it. So I declared the money, and then they said they were going to stop the benefits and investigate. That's fine. So then I said, we've got to wind people up. So she hadn't won. Now, she said she'd washed the jeans in the washing machine. So I said, hang on, your washing machine's black, that's very unusual. We're flogging it. We put the washing machine up for sale on eBay. Press story, £2,000. The washing machine that washed the ticket that didn't win the lottery, £2,000. Thank you very much. Sold the washing machine. I leaked it, you know, she's a joke, you know, she's ordered a jacuzzi thinking she'd won and it's been delivered. Well, you know, they're coming to take it back. She's going mad. So I said, I don't know how we're going to disappoint her. What we're going to do is, so we bought a garden shed. We put a little bath in it, built around it, fancy, painted some fishes on the wall. That was a jacuzzi in the shed. Another press story, £2,000.
Brilliant.
And that's what a publicist does, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You touched upon there, so with the social media and stuff, love that or hate that, use it as a tool, or I know I've seen it, obviously I had you on Facebook and stuff.
Yeah.
How'd you find it?
I adore it in equal measures.
Yeah.
It's one of the best things ever gifted to us as media people. And it's one of the most dangerous. So you've got to decide. A car is not a killer. A bullet is not a killer. It's the person with the car firing the bullets the killer. You've got to decide how you use it. So I use it all the time. I think, quick, nip that on Twitter, because that's a really good one. The press will read it. You used to only be able to have 140 characters, so it was very quick. Barry, what's the story? You're getting engaged. Didn't you tell us? You know, you've suddenly got a 2 grand story. So I adore it. I worry that it's become reality for some people. I mean, I've got 5,000 friends on Facebook, and I know 10 of them personally.
Mm-hmm.
But they are my Facebook friends, and I know that. I know they're not coming to dinner at my house. I know if they want me to do something, they've got to pay me. So it's only good if you manage it. I would say it's probably ruined more lives than it's helped. So would I like to go back to having no internet? I don't think so. Would I like to go back to having, you know, I mean, I'm that old. When we had a telephone, we had a party line. The neighbour and us shared the same number. So when you phoned on the phone, if you picked it up and the neighbour was talking, you had to wait. It was called a party line. And that was back in the Northfield days. Then we had a phone, which was amazing. But I remember going to Greece on one of my holidays, and I wanted to call my mum, and I went to the reception. So I want to call England. I had to book a queue 6 hours later. I could make a call to England. Well, now I'm all over the world, and I'm using WhatsApp. I don't even pay for the calls. See, you know, I've got money for a phone to take your benefits off it. I said, no, I'll use WhatsApp.
You
shouldn't disinvent it.
Yeah.
You can't disinvent the atom bomb.
Think it'd be good to have just 6 weeks off or something. Forever.
Oh, no, it's the best thing to do. What I'd love people to do, and I know people like Nadia Older, and I know Lulu, Factory, I know Lulu saw it with that, and Sheila from 3 Degrees, they're singers and their voices, they talk. Sheila doesn't talk on a Sunday at all. Lulu once lost her voice, and because she was doing a panto, she'd recorded the part in case she lost her voice. And I remember a voice was going, and we were trying, and she had to give me notes. She wrote notes. Barry, drive slower. You're going too fast. Where are we going? I'm just going in here to sign on. But you think that's funny? This is a funny one about Elvin Stardust. Northfield, the doll was in Selly Oak, Oak Tree Lane. My brother Paul was a vagabond, but bless him, he signed on a lot, and he told me where it was. So he's going to sign on. Alvin staying at my mum's house the one day, and we had no internet, we had no mobile phones. So I said, look, Alvin, you just go straight down the Bristol Road, you'll pick back up the flyover, and you'll be back on the way to London. And Paul said, I'm going out. And he said, where are you going? He said, oh, I'm going to Selly Oak. So I'll give you a lift. He said, on the way. I said, will you pass it? I said, but don't, Alvin, it's all right, you know, let go on the bus. So Alvin said, no, I'll give him a lift. Now, Alvin's got black BMW, 28 grand. My mum's house, 22 grand. That's with the downstairs bathroom we wasn't supposed to have that we put in ourselves. Oh, sorry. I'll catch up with you later. So that happens. So I said, look, Alvin, listen to me. When you drive down Selly Oak, when you're on the main Bristol Road, I said, don't turn left into Oak Tree Lane where Paul will tell you to. Drop him off on the corner. He can walk down and then go straight. So, of course, he's driving down, and then Paul said, oh, he's left down here. He said, oh, I'll turn left, Barry. Paul, I'll take you. Alvin Stardust pulls into the doll, where you sign on, the actual doll, drops my brother Paul off, and nearly got him killed. And I'm like, well, how did this happen? What went wrong? My brother Paul gets out of a BMW, walks into the doll, outside the doll, are drug dealers, thinking he's with a drug dealer who's just got out of a BMW and he's come to sell drugs on their patch. I mean, it's a crazy world I live in. It's mad, isn't it?
And if they have a look in the window, Alvin starts.
Yeah, yeah, he's a coo. That was it. So that's how my life, it's still here. I mean, I'm a publicist for homeopathy at the moment. I'm Thursday with King Charles Doctor, and he's going to come in. We're going to record an interview with him. And then he's going straight back to the palace to have dinner with the king. I made a record for the Queen, mum, with Dave Upenslade, down in Arbor at a blind school. They called me and said, oh, you know, you do a publicity, how can we promote it? Well, what's it for? Well, we've got something very special coming, and we can't tell you who it is. That's usually royalty. They don't announce. I said, well, you've got a load of kids, yeah, we'll make a record. So I took Dave Hill to Rich Beach Studios, which is in Sally Oak, and everybody knew for years, with Rob.
Yeah.
I'd got Norma Luz from Shack Attack, I was representing her, and the girl was number one in Portugal, Teresa Niuko. Took them down. We made the Dave insisted on writing the B-side because he got the publishing, so Dave. That's good, Dave, well done. And we released it on my record, on Gotham Records, and on the day, and this is a really funny thing, but I get the royalty, they're good fun, man, I like them. We made the record, and on the day, the kids sung this song, and Dave Hill, myself, Rob, and I said to Rob from Rich Bitch, I'm going to lunch tomorrow. He said, yeah, mate. And I was fine. I said, what are we going to say? No, I'm busy. I said, mate, you're coming to lunch today. You've put me off for years. We're going to go. I said, we're going. Well, I didn't tell him where we were going. So, of course, I take him. We pick up Dave Hill. We get to this blind school in Arbourne. And the Queen Mum is the VIP. So I'd give the lady, you know, with the palace, they give her all the stuff. And I'd like to thank Rob from Dave Hill from Slade. I'd like to thank Teresa Mugo from Portugal Norman News. And at the very bottom, I'd really like to personal thank you to Rob from Rich Bitch Studios in Sally Oak for giving us free studio time. And the woman questioned, do you mind if we don't say Rich Bitch Studios? Can we just say the studio? I said, why? She said, the Queen Mum would like it. I said, she is a rich bitch. She'll love it. But they changed it. Did they? They absolutely changed it.
Even though it's world renowned.
But it's fantastic. It was brilliant. Rich Bitch Studios. Mm. But they didn't want her to say Rich Bitch. And I thought, you should work for Meghan Markle.
So you've built and sold numerous incredible businesses. What's the future? What's the short and long-term future for you?
I'm a publicist, which makes my money. You know, we get about 12 quid a week. I say that for the dogs. You're allowed to earn 17. And basically, that's good, and I love that because you can see how I can make a story, sell the machine, you know, washing machine's crazy. But the Garden Picasso, I am currently filming stuff to do my Garden Picasso TV show. Now, what's great about that is at the tail end of my working career, hopefully it goes on for longer, but at the tail end for sure, I've gone back to my building. So that skills, yeah. So I love that. I also produce television shows. I represent television presenters like Monica Post. We just filmed 6 shows in Coachella Valley High School with the students. We took over, built a studio, built the studio, got £150,000 worth of artwork in there from sculptors that we represent in America, made 6 fantastic TV shows. And we have big people, you know, like some big, like Brian May's been on the show. So it's not just unknown people. It's a lot, and we filmed for about 10 years. She did have a Big Sense TV, she had a show on there. So I'm an executive producer for the TV shows, which I love. I'm enjoying that because I do like saying, well, that's good and that's good, but together they're not good. So let's so and so. I love that. The publisher's work I love because I don't even have to leave my room. I had a 5-roomed office in London. A 2-roomed office in London, a 5-roomed office in Rubri. I had an office in just near the airport in Los Angeles, at Redondo Beach. I've got an office now in Palm Springs and an office in France. And actually, that's my office right there. I don't pay any council tax. I don't pay any rates. I reverse the charges all the time, so I don't pay for them. Gordy. But that's my office. I work. Just before I came in here, I quickly did a couple of emails to Homeopathy, which I'm a publicist for. And we had the Duke of Gloucester last week come to an opening. We did. So for me, I just hope... I hope I keep enjoying it, because I've always said when I stop enjoying it, I'm going to stop. So maybe the fact I keep changing is to make sure I don't stop enjoying it, so I don't do it. So onward and up for me. I love working 7 days a week. I'm back in America in July, back in America in the end of October, because we're filming a documentary about autism. And then my sculptors, you know, the Walk of Stars in Hollywood, well, they also do one in Palm Springs. In fact, they do one in Birmingham, because Ozzy got one.
Yeah.
They do one in Palm Springs. And my sculptor friends that I represent, they're going to be on the Walk of Stars in November in Palm Springs, so that'll be like the end of that trip. So, yeah. Oh, hang on, I've got to go sign up at 3.
How did you, just quickly, how did you get into, because you've made a documentary previously for autism, haven't you?
Yeah.
How did you get
into it? Well, again, I managed Monica, I'm a publicist for Monica Price, the TV presenter. We were filming at Big Sense TV. She had a show called Cup of TV. It was on Monday to Thursday every week. Then on Friday, it was the best of. An author came on from New York, and she was an author, and she was the guest, and she brought some books in about autism. And we got talking, and I said, you know, what next? She said, well, I'd love to make a documentary about autism. I said, well, you can make a documentary about anything, but you'd need cameras, you need people, you need money. And she said, well, how much would it cost? And this was 7 years ago. I said, well, it depends how long you're going to work it. I said, but you need about 10, 20 grand to get footage and then decide what to use and then the editing. And she said, leave it with me. 2 years later, I get a phone call. I've got 10 grand. And I said, it's gone up to 12 now. Bit slow, 2 years, you want it? We went to Jamaica. We went to New York, New Jersey, and filmed. We filmed in Scotland. We filmed in Wales. And we did this documentary. Now, we'd got about 40 hours of footage. But the PR guy here was banging it out on the socials. We got a call from the Royal Television Society. Hi, Barry. We really want you to submit your film about autism to the thing. I said, well, it's not ready. It's not edited. What do you mean? I said, well, it's not, we haven't even got a TV channel for it yet. No, we really want you to do it. Want to be in it. It's a big thing. Autism's a big thing. So I said, well, what are the rules? Just stick it on YouTube. I said, no, listen. I didn't do all that to put it on YouTube. Anybody can put it on YouTube. Unless this goes on a television channel, I'm not going to work with it. So we spoke to a television channel, the one I did the Garden Picasso with, and I said, let me do an 11-minute segment, and it's called Let Me In. That was the title I gave it. In other words, don't get autistic people into your world because they're not coming. Ask them to let you into their world. Then we did it as a short story. Got nominated for an award for the Royal Television Society. They came over from Jamaica, some people came, we had the big table. And I said to them, I said, guys, thanks you all for coming. Absolutely amazing. I said, we're not going to win this award today. Now, when it came up on the screen, BBC, whatever it was, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, Barry Tones Media Group at the bottom. Well, I'd won. I'm still from Norfolk, mate. That's me, right there. I said, we're not going to win. I said, and I'll tell you why we're not going to win. The BBC have been doing an amazing documentary for you, and I've just noticed that's the one they've submitted. And it was Ed Doolan from WM, who was massive on the channel. He'd got Alzheimer's, and they followed him for the last year of his life. I said, not only is he going to win, he deserves to win. For me, even being on that page, oh, no, we could win. I said, enjoy your meal, have a great night. You're all winners. I've got the top prize, I could have. And he did win, which I expected. And you know, I've been friends with the Royal Television Society ever since, and we offer them stuff, and we do stuff, and I go to various events. So that, again, was just something.
It's from, like another pitch from our bailout.
Yeah. Well, when I turned BBC, and I thought, just, and it was Barry Jones Media, which was unbelievable. You know, and the thing is, they spelled my name right. It's Tomes. It's Tomes. Maybe they should have put a Z on it, would have made it easier. Blame me, Dad. Thomas. Tunes, all the top Tunes. Tomes with a B. They just can't say Tomes. And I don't know why they can't say Tomes. And I said, but it's not two O's, it's not Tomes, it's not Tomes, it's not Thomas, it's Tomes.
Maybe an hour before the end.
Yeah, maybe. But for me, that's the only thing I beat you up for. You probably know.
Mm-hmm. I'll make sure that I'll definitely get it.
Yeah, I'll bet you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're not using this podcast. This is Barry Thomas from Norfolk. So I'm very privileged to be a Brummie, because I genuinely, being a Brummie and drinking 7 Trent water has given me the spirit I've got. I have lived and moved all around the world doing stuff. There ain't no sarcasm like there is in Brum. And you can't take the piss out of anybody like you can in Brum. Even now, people don't get offended when you take the piss out of them. They love it. You only got to go to London, it's like another country. You don't even smile at anybody. You know, so I'm proud to be a Brummie, and I will never stop banging the drum for Birmingham.
Perfect. It's been amazing having you on.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
It's
been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Thank you both.